best-selling author and Stanford Medical School professor Abraham Verghese has a new novel, a sweeping epic following three generations of a family in southwest India across the 20th century. The Covenant of Water will delight fans of his 2012 novel Cutting for Stone, which sold over a million copies and remained on the New York Times bestseller list for over 2 years. This latest story centres on a young Christian girl in Kerala. She's married to a 40-year-old widower. It follows the family she becomes the matriarch of over decades, in which India changes enormously. Abraham Verghese was born and grew up in Ethiopia, the son of expatriate Indian parents. He began medical school in Ethiopia, but his studies were interrupted by the civil war in 1974. He completed them in India before moving to the United States. He'll be appearing live at the Auckland Writers' Festival next month. He's with us now from San Francisco. Abraham, thank you so much. Lovely to talk to you.
My pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Let's learn a little more of the inspiration of this book. I think it largely draws on the story of your great-grandmother.
Yes, it does. It draws very much on my family, but it really began because my mother, when she was in her late 70s, was asked by her five-year-old niece, who said, "Amichi, what was it like when you were a five-year-old girl?" And my mother began to pen these anecdotes of her childhood. And when I saw the manuscript, I realized that this was such a rich, closed community in which to set a novel. So that was really the inspiration. That's where it all began.
She began writing this, I think she was in her 70s at the time. Doesn't it show the stories we carry of our lives and the gold that can be found within them?
Yeah, I think it was a reminder to me of the richness of family, and especially the sort of heroic women whose stories go unheralded, unrecognized. And yet, you know, we all know people like that who are linchpins to their families and who endure great suffering, but somehow manage to go on. And both my grandmothers were individuals like this. So it was lovely to, you know, research the time period of their childhood and of their parents' childhood, and then develop the story over three generations.
So big Amichi, which means mother, I think. She is our protagonist here. There are many characters, however, many strands. Would you describe her as a matriarch? It suggests an overbearingness that perhaps is lacking here. What is here is an extraordinary strength and resilience and maternal leadership, yes?
Yes, I think she, you know, is sort of an atypical heroine, if you like. I think the book begins with a very difficult premise for most Western readers, a young girl essentially marrying an older man. But I think the thing to keep in mind is that they don't really consummate anything till many, many years later. And it's not atypical for that era for young children to be brought together and become children in another household under the supervision of the mother-in-law. This was slightly different, and she basically grows into this tremendous role. And I think the thing that keeps her going is not just the strength of her character, but her faith, the concreteness of her faith, which was fairly typical of my grandmother's and of that era.
It is exactly as you describe these opening pages, that the reader is immediately trepidatious at the prospect of a 12-year-old, I think, marrying a 40-year-old man. But this is where we see a love story in all its elements. His first instinct is, goodness, this is a child. And he cares for her first as a child, and deeply cares for her. It is a love story in every sense before it becomes an adult love story.
Yes, indeed. I think, you know, it's somewhat beautiful to see a love story in a setting that most people don't associate with love. I mean, she begins being very fearful of her older, somewhat fearsome husband, and he's a very quiet man, but it grows into, over the course of many decades, into a very beautiful love story. And I think it echoes what I heard about my grandmother, my great-grandmother, who married very young to an older man, a widower, and by all accounts, they had the most wonderful marriage, full of humor and full of a great deal of love. So I was trying to very much echo that. But the sort of conceit that runs through the book and plays out over several generations is the family is cursed by this condition where one or more individuals drowns easily even though they avoid water, which in Kerala, South India, water is everywhere. And so the conceit of the book is to unfold that mystery, which, as a physician myself, I really enjoyed telling that story because it represents an arc in my own career, watching diseases that we had a label for but never understood evolve into something where we know the cause and we have a treatment.
And this is where two significant strands of your life come together. It is significant to Bigamachi in this early love story also, because she is first a carer and then absolutely a stepmother to her husband's young son. And then we have the first of many tragedies. But to the role of water and why this is the particular malady or particular curse for this family, could you tell us a little more of the setting of Kerala in southwest India? It sounds absolutely beautiful, and water is everywhere.
Yeah, Kerala is a very different part of India. It almost feels like another country. It's a narrow strip of coastline on the western edge, and inland, it's only about 80 miles wide at its widest. And just inland is this mountain range, and it's on the slopes of this mountain range coming down to the ocean that spices grow abundantly. And this was called the Spice Coast for many years. But 40 rivers run down to the sea and they break into a latticework of lagoons, ponds, canals, backwaters. So, it's a wonderful watery setting, and the annual monsoon is the great beating heart of this circulatory system that seems to connect everybody. And I loved it as a child, and I thought it was a great setting for a novel, very different.
As you do, the influence of your thinking as a physician, your thinking of the biology, the physiology of the human being, is often on display. And this is a rather beautiful way of describing it as the circulatory system. But of course, the conceit of the novel again is what a terrible affliction to have if water is something that you and your family cannot cope with. Could you hint a little more at this premise for the story?
Yeah, I think this is actually a real condition that affects people. It's very rare. And as a longtime teacher of medicine, I often keep rare diseases in my back pocket, so to speak. Things that I bring out and ask in the form of a riddle or a question to my trainees if there's a quiet moment. And this was one that I tucked away for a long time. And I didn't actually know that it existed to that degree in India, but it turns out it does exist there too. And I thought it would be a great sort of thing to impose on this generations of family, have them wrestle with it, and ultimately have one person sort it out. I wouldn't want to give too much away. I think part of the joy of reading, I hope, is to find out what it is.
We'll hint a little more, but suffice to say, tragedy enters our protagonist's life at that young age, and it's a tragedy repeated throughout the family's history. And this family grows and shrinks over time. There are births, there are tragic deaths, and all the time in the background, this condition. We do move fairly early, and let's introduce another character, if you would, to Glasgow in 1919, where we first meet Digby. Could you introduce listeners a little to this part of the story?
I think I was trying to be true to the times because if you think about India in that era, 1900 to 1970, at least till 1945 or so, you really couldn't talk about India without talking about the British being there. This was, part of Imperial Britain, and the rulers were the British, and the medical system, even though it had many Indian physicians, was entirely set up and run, at least in the Western tradition, by people from the UK. And so to have a Scottish physician would not have been atypical at all. And I have some affinity for Scotland, lots of friends there. And so I made my protagonist someone I invented from Glasgow, which was, I think added a rich element to me because this was a person who was discriminated against in Scotland for being Catholic. And the moment he arrives in India, his status is elevated because, he's now in the ruling class. And it was fun to play against those polarities, if you like, in the same individual.
Well, this and the absurdity of the way we classify in all our cultures is another theme of the book. And, it sweeps through time and history, through British colonialism, through independence, through many reckonings explored through the characters, and is thematically also sweeping. And, for example, the caste system, the debt owed by one class to another, by labourer to landowner. Your characters delve into this at key moments of the book, Abraham.
Yeah, I think people sometimes think that I'm trying to proselytize or take a political stance, but I was really trying to describe what was true of that era. You know, you had the irony of, another country, Britain, imposing its will on India for centuries, really. And yet within those that they were imposing on, there was a long history of different stratas of society being very, very prejudiced and ruling in a manner that, you know, disadvantaged the community below them. So layers and layers of oppression, if you like. It was fun to take my characters through them and have them struggle with it politically and socially.
Our guest is Abraham Verghese. We are talking about his latest novel, The Covenant of Water. He's coming to New Zealand for the Auckland Writers' Festival. 18 minutes past 10 it is. You're listening to 9 to Noon on RNZ National. Fans of Cutting the Stone will recognise your medical knowledge coming through, not just in scenes where people are afflicted by various diseases or scars or developmental challenges, addictions, but also in the writing itself. There is a scalpel cleanliness to the way in which your other expertise and indeed your other form of writing informs your fiction writing. Is that just innate? Is it just a natural way for a writer to use what one knows?
Yes, I think you're always advised to, you know, use what you know, which might be a little difficult if you're an accountant, for example. Nothing against accountants, but I think the great joy of medicine is that in the nature of it, it's a very human endeavor. You're listening to stories. You get a history, which is a story, and then you're looking at the body, you're reading the body, trying to put these disparate clues together to form a whole. So there's something about the exercise of medicine that I think really lends itself to the writing of novels. And I'm also not apologetic about using medicine in a novel, because the way I think of medicine is, what is medicine but life plus plus, life on steroids, life at its most acute moments, the most tragic and intense moments. So it's sort of natural that I would gravitate to that drama rather than something else, for example. So I've enjoyed both being a physician and using the skills I might have to write about that. And conversely, I think that the writing has informed my medicine. I'm much more aware of story. I'm listening for story, not in a mercenary way to use it, but I'm sort of more attuned to how story operates in all our lives,
including how we convey information, how we remember. Story is at the heart of the human experience and how it is shared. To your earlier point, I was just thinking how many reality TV shows are set in EDs and emergency departments. There's a wonderful one just on last night here, set in London, 24 hours in an emergency department. But this is a different kind of approach. This isn't the, you know, all hands on deck to save a life moment. This is often tracking the evolution of our understanding of disease and indeed being able to identify it, diagnose it, even treat it over time. And is that another reason you enjoy the sweep of history?
I think the reason I like the sweep of history, one was that it's just a lovely way to develop a story fully. As a reader, I've always loved the kind of big novels that you pick up and you're transported into this other world, and you live through generations and wars and deaths and famines, and you put the book down finally and it's just Tuesday. I love that feeling of being transported in time. But more than that, I think the time period I picked was, as you said earlier, is inherently interesting. World War One and Two, the end of British occupation, so many rich medical discoveries. I've been practicing for about 40 years, and in that time, just to see the sweep of progress we've made in science, things that we didn't even learn about in medical school that have now been unfolded and, you know, become therapies that you can buy over the counter. It's just astonishing to me. So why not include that in the substance of a novel? It seemed fair enough to me.
I'm interested also in your experience, not only of writing the story, that's somewhat where things begin, the personal editing and then the consequent editing and publishing as part of the story as well, because you were prepared to fight hard for it to be the way you wanted it to be. I think you've written of the challenges. It's 700 pages. Switching publisher and editor partway through. What were the circumstances of that? Just not being prepared to just fit it into a box or what?
Well, I'm sure it was partly my fault. I think with the success of Cutting for Stone, I had a lot of wonderful publishers coming at me, offering large advances, and I sort of succumbed to the sense of I'm the golden goose, and they think I can lay another golden egg, and I think I can do it. And as it turned out, the reality was that I was writing at a much slower pace than they were ready for. And then when I really felt I had a great story in my hand, at that point, the first publisher was, I think, much more concerned about page length, and I just felt that, I was not in a good place with them, and I write so slowly that I don't have the luxury of watching someone take 10 years of my work and reduce it to something else. And so I broke my contract and still owe them money that I had to pay back, this advance, and shopped around for another publisher. And I would have been very happy just to see the book get in print, and for me to find another wonderful publisher at Grove and a great editor with Peter Blackstock, who did the Sympathizer, and that author is also going to be there in New Zealand and Australia. To me, that was just it's just gravy. My talking to you feels like just a wonderful miracle. So I am extremely happy that the book is out, and I can't even believe the kind of reception it's been having. So I'm blessed, truly.
Medicine, your first love. As we said, you studied first in Ethiopia, then India, then the United States. You're a professor at Stanford University Medical School. It sounds actually like the basis for your next novel. I think you already have written memoir, but it's an extraordinary life. At what point did the writing get serious? Just reading your biography, it seemed to be a quite deliberate decision at a point in time.
Yeah, I never really set out to be a writer. I loved the ideas of medicine as a child, and I felt that it was a romantic and passionate pursuit, and all because of certain books, which in my case were The Citadel by A.J. Cronin and Of Human Bondage by Somerset Maugham. I don't quite know how, but they made medicine seem to me a romantic and passionate pursuit, and I still feel that way. I began to write because, as an infectious disease specialist in the 80s, I moved to a small town in Tennessee, a small medical school, and everyone said I would see one HIV infected person every other year. But instead, in a short time, I'd accumulated almost 100 people with HIV infection. And I felt I'd stumbled onto a paradigm of migration that was probably happening in every small town in America. And it represented gay men leaving small towns in their youth for education, jobs, but also because they were gay, and then moving to the big cities and spending decades there, finding themselves. But then the virus had found them, they'd lost their partners, and now they were coming home, and I was their physician. And I wrote a scientific paper describing this epic journey of theirs. But I always felt that the language of science, even though the paper was very widely cited, I felt the language of science never captured the tragic nature of this voyage, the heartbreak for the families, and my own grief at watching this again and again. And I resolved to tell that story, and that was my first book, My Own Country. And when it did very well, when it was well received, I guess I caught the writing bug. Instead of playing golf, I write.
What is interesting is that you have kept up a very full professional career. You'll have goodness knows how many lawyers who start writing, and thanks very much. I won't say they're playing golf because they work and write very hard. The challenge of keeping up two very demanding careers, how do you make that work?
Well, for one thing, I write very slowly, so I'm not in a great hurry. I think there's a maybe it's just an American tick or it's a worldwide tick where you do something successfully and the very next question becomes, well, what's next? As though you're not allowed to relish this thing that you built, and I don't feel that same compulsion. I will write a book again, I'm sure. I will write another book, but I'm also very content if nothing happens. I really like my life. I should also say that I'm a more senior physician now, and so I have less of the frontline stuff. I mean, I could do more if I wanted to, but I'm also have the luxury of withdrawing just a little bit and spending more time with my trainees and watching them take it on. It's not as though I'm working, long, long hours right there in the hospital and coming back. I mean, I have a lot more leeway, but overall, I honestly would worry if I stopped being a physician. I would worry because then this writing would become a full-time serious business, and I think that would be crippling to me at this point.
It would become the thing. Just to finish with your medical knowledge and expertise, you alluded to it earlier. You're very big on what is now becoming a much more recognised issue, which is the patient's story and the patient full stop. And medicine, I mean, it is brutal in those early years, as you well know. We just had Adam Kay on yesterday talking about his 96-hour weeks in the NHS. And it risks sometimes dehumanising everybody. But you have always been very on point with the need for the patient to be a person, to walk in the patient's shoes, and you've taught that to your students. Was that, again, just a natural way of being for you?
I think it has been a product of the wonderful mentors and teachers that I've had. And I think the only way to convey that kind of tradition is somewhat inefficiently. You have to do it one-on-one on rounds with your interactions. You have to model the behavior you want to see. Unfortunately, I think the great lure of technology, makes us think that we can somehow do all this stuff remotely. And I keep having to remind students, and they don't really need reminding. They came to medicine hoping it would be what I think it should be, and that is not a transactional relationship, but a relational one. I think it's a human being coming to you in some distress, and they're not looking to plug their data into a machine and have a spit out. They're looking for care. Someone, a famous physician, Peabody, said 100 years ago, "The secret of the care of the patient is in caring for the patient." That has not changed since antiquity. So I do have that reputation in medicine for championing this cause, but it's sort of a false one. I think I'm just holding up the great tradition that somehow has been watered down by all the distractions of all the wonderful things we can do in medicine, but they don't change the relational nature of our transactions. It's not transactional. It's a pure one-on-one relationship where it all should begin.
Are you wary as a final observation with the post-pandemic trend and the understandable technological trend towards much more telehealth, much more distance health? Goodness, let's get people help first and foremost. But are you wary of that crowding out and systems crowding out that face-to-face personal contact?
Yeah, I think there definitely is a place for telemedicine. We don't really need people to come in and find parking and come and sit in the waiting room. There are many things that one can do remotely, and I think telemedicine was a revelation for me, especially because I felt skeptical. But to be honest, working on videos and for the first time getting a glimpse into a patient's house or realizing that they're calling in from their car and they're parked outside a Holiday Inn or some other hotel because they don't have Wi-Fi at home, and so for all the lip service we have been giving to patients' social situation, this was telemedicine was one of the or video medicine was one of the first ways we actually began to see into patients' homes. So I'm actually grateful for that. So I think we need a medley of things, and there are many conditions for which perhaps a video visit is fine. But when we're talking about more serious illness, I think it becomes terribly important for the patient to have the sense that there is someone in charge and someone who feels their angst. And especially in the examination of the body, which is something I champion, something we are supposed to do, something we often claim to do, but don't necessarily do as claimed, that there's something not just informational that you're gathering. You're not just reading the body for data points, but you're also performing a ritual that allows the patient to feel that you have now placed their ailment not on a computer printout somewhere or a biopsy report or an X-ray or MRI. You have managed to place it on their body. So there's something very symbolic and important about that. And I actually feel embarrassed that I have to keep, championing what should be fundamental to us, but it is under threat.
Thank you for your time, Abraham Verghese. And the novel is The Covenant of Water. And Abraham will be appearing at the Auckland Writers' Festival next month. More details on the RNZ 9 Tonen website.